Welcome to the Native Advertising Powerhouse, a podcast dedicated to help publishers and native ad studio professionals build a solid framework for their native advertising efforts. The host of the show is Jesper Lawson, founder of the Native Advertising Institute.
My name is Jesper Lawson, and you're listening to the second episode of the Native Advertising Powerhouse. Today, we are welcoming Farah Warner. Farah has been named one of 100 significant women in native advertising, and she will be speaking at our conference Native Advertising Days in Berlin this November 6th through 8th. It is, by the way, the biggest native advertising event on the planet with attendees from more than 30 countries, and you can check it out at nativeadvertisinginstitute.com/days. Now, if you can make it to Berlin, at least you now have the opportunity to learn from one of the smartest people in native advertising, Farah Warner. Welcome on the show, Farah.
It's great to be here. Thanks very much, Jesper.
Okay. So could you start out by telling us a little bit about your background and your experience with native advertising?
Sure. So I consider myself a journalist. I've been a journalist for more than 3 decades now. And my experience with native advertising started actually when I was the editorial director at AOL. We had started to think about different types of editorial series that we wanted to do. And we started around this idea of the reemergence of American manufacturing, particularly after the financial crisis, the Great Recession. And long story short, that became a program called This Built America. And everyone loved the idea, but as is true in a lot of journalism, the ability for AOL or any large publisher to send a group of people out on the road for a year, which was the conceit of the idea, which was 50 stories in 50 states, with 50 companies, and it would be a year-long repertorial investigation. So to be able to fund something like that, because it included video and photography, we needed a sponsor. And that was, in fact, the first time in my career as a journalist that I went before potential clients and pitched this idea. We ended up having Ford Trucks come in as the sponsor, and it was a great partnership and a very, I would say, for the client, I know now we're several years out from it, was a great experience. And for me as a journalist was the first experience that I had in balancing the needs of an advertiser with my requirements as a journalist. So that was my first experience with native advertising. And from there, I left AOL and then joined the Wall Street Journal as first global editorial director for WSJ Custom Studios, and left the company just last year as the vice president of custom content.
And before we dive a little bit more into your own personal experiences, how was it for the editorial project to have a sponsor like Ford on board?
I think what was important for the editorial team to understand, and it was a very small editorial team, was that we were going to set the guidelines and the creative boundaries with the client up front. We sat down in a meeting with them in the very beginning and said, what are the things that you need from us as an editorial team, and can we deliver those? And there were really only 2 requirements. One was that we work together on choosing the states where we were going to do larger video narratives. So we chose a dozen states where Ford needed to make a big splash in the marketplace. Either it was a conquest state where they don't sell a lot of trucks, or it was deeply embedded in their, where they sell a lot of trucks. And so we chose those states together. And then the other requirement was that we couldn't cover any alcohol or liquor companies because drinking and driving don't mix. And that was their one question to us. And we're like, sure, we should not have a problem doing that. And of course, we said that, and then we got to Kentucky, which is the land of bourbon. And there are some great local bourbon manufacturers. But in the end, we actually, even with that creative restraint, if you will, we found this amazing company in Kentucky that I actually thought was even a better story, which was a beekeeping company, a company that actually creates equipment for beekeepers. And given the social consciousness around bees and around the environment, it actually ended up being a much better story. Those were really the only requirements that Ford asked of us.
And so one thing is setting up the boundaries beforehand. I could foresee situations where the reality would be different. How was it in that project? Did Ford, you know, stick with those two requirements?
They did. I think they trusted us. I think that's another important factor in this world in which you're combining two very different crafts. And this goes to the difference between journalism and marketing. We may end up in the same place. We may end up with the same story, if you will. But journalists start from a very different perspective than a marketer starts. And so I think it's learning to trust and respect each other's crafts and where we come from, and then move forward from there. And Ford was a great client. I'll tell this story. It was interesting because I wrote the first article, which was about a company called Shinola, which is based in Michigan. And obviously Michigan is the hometown of Ford. And when I was describing where the company is based, I said, in the shadow of the former General Motors headquarters, because in fact, factually, where Shinola is based is literally within the shadow of the old GM headquarters. Mm. They're based in a building called the Argonaut Building. And so I wrote the story, we published it, and I got a call from one of my salespeople asking if we could change that. And I said, well, no, we can't change it. It's a fact. And I said, I respectfully would ask you to go back to the client and let them know that it seems like a small thing, but a fact is a fact. And if I was going to change it, as I said to our salesperson, if I'm going to change it, I'm going to need to rewrite the entire, probably top half of the story, because I'm not just going to take it out. I'm not just going to sort of dress up that lead, because my lead was important to me. And I wanted people to understand that out of the ashes of sort of the former glory of Detroit, because the GM headquarters that I was referencing is no longer the General Motors headquarters. Mm. It's an old, beautiful building that I believe has been taken over by the city government. But out of that, out of all of this manufacturing history, is rising this company that builds bikes and watches and leather goods. And so I explained that to him. He went back to the client, and the client said, okay, we understand. And that was the only time when we had that creative difference. And I will say, if push had come to shove, obviously, and it was really something that Ford felt was important, I would have sat down with them and led them through my reasoning, but also been clear that if I was going to change it, then the story was going to change and I was going to have to rewrite. Because I don't think it's fair to just say in the shadow of a former large American manufacturer, like that doesn't make any sense.
No.
And that's kind of a long-winded way of saying we had a great relationship at AOL with Ford Trucks.
But the request of if not changing, then maybe hiding the facts a little bit, was that a request from the client or was it your salesperson that kind of put that in?
It was a request from the client, because General Motors obviously is a large competitor of Ford. The request came through what was actually very good, normal, I think a very strong channel. And again, this is one of the things that I learned as I moved into working at the Wall Street Journal, is very strong salespeople who can navigate both the client side as well as the internal side are very important. And this salesperson really understood that he had a great relationship with the client, and he knew that he could come to me and ask me those questions and I would give him my honest answer. So I do think that those lines of communication are important. And again, laying out what the roles and responsibilities are of everyone on the team. And I think salespeople are critically important to the process, not just when you're selling a program in, but through the entire life of the program, because they hold the client relationship. Because that client might decide next time they don't want to do custom content, they want to run a straightforward brand ad. Well, that's never going to be something I'm working on in custom content, but that salesperson still has to maintain a great relationship with the client. I actually think that's where those conversations can start, those difficult conversations and those requests.
The experience that you had with this Ford collaboration, and in terms of setting up clear expectations with the client, I'm sure that's something a lot of publishers out there are struggling with. Do you have any advice for them in terms of what are the important things to be clear about upfront?
I think that first and foremost is setting roles and responsibilities on both sides so that everyone understands who to go to when something goes wrong and also who to go to when something goes right. Because lots of programs, I will say 90% of programs that we worked on at Custom Studios, at WSJ Custom Studios, ran quite well without very many problems or hiccups. There are always going to be those 10% where something goes awry, something happens, and you need to solve those problems. I think the other thing that we at the studio in particular, but also what I learned from Ford, was setting those boundaries early on and getting clients to understand that custom content is distinctly different from traditional advertising. And together we're embarking on a collaborative process. And that means that there's going to be conversations and continuation of conversations and reiterating those boundaries throughout the life of the program. And I think when I would see programs begin to have problems is when we would allow a client to do something that was maybe outside the boundaries of those bounds that we had set. And then trying to pull them back into those boundaries is really hard because we've said yes to something that potentially we shouldn't have said yes to. Mm. And I know people are probably listening to this and cringing because it's like, well, you always say yes to a client. I would argue that as a publisher studio, you are always required to keep one group of people in mind, and that is your audience. Because what we are selling in custom content is, yes, all this wonderful, beautiful, creative that all of us do in publisher studios. But primarily what we were really selling to a client is access to our audience and an understanding of that audience. Hmm. So when I say to a client, I don't think a story should be written this way, I don't think the storyline of a video works, is not because I don't want to do it or my team doesn't want to do it, but because we understand our audience and we understand what they are going to gravitate to and what they're going to want to watch and listen and read. And so as an example, at the studio at Wall Street Journal, we became well known for long form narratives, long reads, because our audience as WSJ readers, that's what they do. That's what the journal does. And that's what the journal does well on the editorial side are long reads. You know, Cocaineonomics, I think, ran to almost past 4,000 words. The program that we did for Billions, which was a television show created by Showtime, I wrote the article, The History of Hedge, and that ran to almost 3,000 words. Now, you know, there is this constant sort of like, oh, I want more snappy, I want shareable. We can do that, but we always have to remember who our audience is. So I think that that also is, it gives a publisher studio a firm foundation to say, I'm making these choices not because I don't want to do something or I'm being difficult to work with. I'm doing this because here's our audience set. Here's what they like to read and look at and watch and listen to. And therefore, I want to create a custom content program that is going to, will attract them and will be something that they want to engage with.
So it's very much about staying true to the DNA of your publication and being pretty firm on that you know best what will engage the audience?
I believe so. I know that as custom content has and native, whatever we choose to call this, as it has grown and become more formal and has actually become very much a mainstream piece of what marketers do, is that publishers are thinking about becoming more like creative agencies and being able to do any type of custom content. And while I understand the need in terms of business model, I would argue against that, in that then what makes my publisher studio different from another publisher studio? So now I'm just, not only now am I competing with publisher studios, but now I'm competing with a much larger universe of creative shops out there. Mm-hmm. Now I'm competing against amazing filmmakers who are like, yeah, I can make that for you, or amazing writers who are like, I can write that for you. And so I do believe that you have to stay very strongly focused on what your publisher's brand is, and what, as you said very rightly, the DNA of that publisher, because that is why audience comes to read The Wall Street Journal or Quartz or BuzzFeed or Vox or Vice or any of these. And when I say those brands, you know exactly what those brands are. You can almost imagine who the person is in the audience who's watching that or reading it. And that's incredibly powerful. And losing that, I think can be very detrimental.
But at the same time, you know, we talk to tons of publishers who are, you know, stressing over budgets. They need to make more money. And one of the ways, one of the things that are tempting to them is, at least, you know, to run native programs that is, you know, well beyond their own platforms, to, mm-hmm. you know, to pick up those money that would be in Facebook or would be on other platforms. It's pretty understandable that they're trying to go after that. But would you advise against that?
What I would advise is having a more, how do I put this? Thinking through your business model and thinking through your revenue streams, and instead of thinking about it as a single revenue stream, that you think about, well, I've built out this studio, you know, what are the three or four different revenue streams that I can bring together to make up a solid business? And I think because custom content grew so quickly, it became just, there's one revenue stream and it is custom content, and we're going to deliver it exactly the same way and exactly the same format. And the only way that we can grow is to keep making bigger and bigger programs, selling more and more programs. And I think that there is a really great role within a custom content team of the person who looks at future revenue ideas. And I can't say that I have the answer for this, because this is the problem across all of publisher studios, is growing revenue, scaling, not just growing, but scaling your business while maintaining, controlling for cost, not building out an entire newsroom. And so I do think that there are ways to think about custom content in different ways. So I think you can have the large scale, those big, beautiful programs we all know and love, those heroic ones. I think you can think more about renewal. We spent a lot of time at WJ Custom Studios thinking about what would be the next project we were going to work on for this company. And I think renewal is really, really important, because I do know that there's been lots of conversation that companies do custom content and then they leave it. They're like, I don't want to go down that path anymore. And for some companies, it's simply because their marketing changes, maybe their CMO changes. But I also think that sometimes it's just really hard and they don't understand the commitment and also the resource strain on their people with inside the client. But renewal is really important. I think thinking differently about distribution strategies. So being able to take one of those big, beautiful programs, and how do you distribute differently to audiences, yes, that might be outside of your sort of native world. And by that, I mean, what are the other brands within your portfolio? In Dow Jones, where I was at, we were lucky we had a broad range of portfolio brands. So not just the Journal, but Barron's and MarketWatch and others and WSJ Magazine. I think for smaller brands, it becomes more difficult because there's just one single brand. But I think renewal is a place to really think about it. And also, what are the partnerships as well, potentially, that can be built with clients and that the content that we produce for them? One of the things that I felt not bad about, but sort of sad and disheartened is you would create these beautiful things and then they would just be on your platform, on WSJ. And I always thought, well, if the client could take that and use it on their platforms and then backing into that revenue model, is there a way to create revenue, recurring revenue for a studio when the client uses that content in other places? I go back to my point. I think that we haven't spent enough time of thinking about what are the future revenue possibilities for custom content. And instead have had, and I understand the decision to do it, is just how can we make more of this and how can we make more of it for clients who maybe aren't quite right for our brand, maybe want us to do different things that aren't really within our brand's DNA, because that's a pretty simple thing to do, but it may not be the long lasting thing to do, because creativity is expensive. You know, newsrooms are expensive, creative studios are expensive to run. And I think at the end of the day, you also have to figure out what are your expectations in terms of profit margin.
But I'm assuming that, you know, if you want a brand to renew the engagement with a studio, you'd need to make sure that you give them value. I mean, as a publisher, you're used to creating valuable content for your audience that will engage them. Mm-hmm. But it's a different story creating value for the advertiser.
Absolutely. I think creating value for the advertiser is also thinking more holistic. And this is one area that I think both at AOL and at WSJ Studio and other places that I've seen is really creating a more holistic environment for that client. So it's not just the custom content that's going to run on digital, but it might be something that also runs in print and in magazines. It might be live events. It might be creating a series of salon dinners. So really starting to think beyond just the traditional native and saying, how do we bring this brand to our audience potentially in different ways? And allow that brand to interact with our audience, whether it be at a live event or within print. And that, I think, did lead for us to a number of renewals, because we were often thinking about, well, what if we could do X? What if we could take that big, beautiful thing we created for digital and put it on huge television screens at a live event? Yeah. So I think one of the issues with publishers, and particularly those publishers who've come from, you know, traditional print and even traditional digital advertisers, is understanding that there's never going to be a point in time where everything feels comfortable, where the money's just coming in and it's all going to be wonderful. I don't think publishing is that business anymore. I think publishing is a competitive, intense business that is constantly being created. And either you're a part of that creativity and you're also a part of that creative destruction sometimes and not doing the same thing that you've always been doing, or you're going to come up against the likes of the next competitor. You're going to have to face the Facebooks and the Googles and the Instagrams and, you know, all of those platforms as well. And I think thinking that, oh, native or custom was going to be the magic bullet that was going to save publishers, it isn't. And there probably isn't a single silver bullet.
But I see a lot of publishers, and I think that ties into still staying true to your DNA. I see a lot of publishers that are expanding their own editorial offerings with live events, for example, or They're adding influencer networks to their offerings, but they're still staying within the vicinity of their own brand. So they're not like all of a sudden, if they're the Wall Street Journal, try to act as BuzzFeed or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there probably might be a way for, you know, getting more sources of revenue while still staying true to your DNA.
I agree, because I also think one of the things that we could do better at is aligning the custom content advertising part of our business with what is happening on the editorial side. And as I said, I've been a journalist for more than 30 years. I have a deep trust in a sharp dividing line between editorial and advertising. But I think that there can be conversations across that line to say, well, what are you doing? Well, what are you thinking about doing? What can serve both purposes while still remaining true to an editorial team that does not have any engagement with the advertiser, doesn't have engagement with clients, but that we can understand if you're going to go into live journalism or you're going to make a massive push into podcasting, well, we on the advertising side, on the custom side, we need to know that because then we can begin to mirror our products along with you and build revenue across the company. That at the end of the day, you know, for me, moving into custom content was a major shift in the trajectory of my career. I didn't really expect to move into custom content. I thought, well, you know, after AOL, or maybe there's something else within AOL, but I saw an opportunity to move over to the revenue side of the business and continue to build revenue for the journalism that I love, and continuing to build revenue so that we can still have newsrooms and editorial teams. Because at the end of the day, inside of the publisher, that's what you're doing, building enough revenue that you can keep sending out investigative journalists to do the work that they need to do for, you know, people to cover Washington, for people to cover international politics, whatever it is. And so that was one of my, you know, struggles as I made the decision to move. Is this the trajectory that I want my career to go?
And how was the reactions when you pivoted from journalism into the branded content?
Reactions have been, for the most part, positive. I've been in this business now, I would say I joined WJ Custom Studios in 2015. So I've had a good, a good run at this. AOL, I was very much still editorial, very much aligned with editorial in the newsroom. I think I've only had a few times where journalists who were not necessarily as close to me, so maybe not friends or former colleagues, really question custom content. And I think that that's fair. I think there was a concern, although I think it's less now, that, it was blurring the lines between journalism and advertising. We had, some sort of these symbolic problems that came up, symbolic anecdotes where you had publishers using their editorial teams for custom content, which I think is really detrimental to the publisher and to the journalists. And I also think in the end, potentially for the client, that isn't a good way to go. So I understood why they had the questions. But for me, it was an opportunity to learn a lot more about the revenue side of the business and what actually makes money, as well as continuing to do what I feel is great journalism and great storytelling, and having the opportunity to do that.
I've had the discussion with Pete Wooden, who is the managing director of Dennis Publishing in the UK, and they're actually using their editorial staff to create native advertising. Now, he feels that it allows them to create better content because it is journalists who are already, diving deep into that subject and knowing exactly how to communicate in the way that Dennis Publishing's different brands need. So he has a different perspective on that. Would you disagree that that could coexist?
I do disagree. I understand the reason for doing it. I understand desiring to monetize your newsroom. But I think that it raises, for me, questions as a reader as to what's the journalism on, you know, the newsroom side, and then what's the brand journalism that's happening on the other side. And if it's that same person writing, one day I'm writing about, I'm being critical or I'm investigating something and writing about it on the newsroom side, and the next day I'm being asked to write something for a brand that might go counter to what I believe on as a journalist and what I've learned as a journalist in my reporting and my sourcing, I think that's a difficult position to put a newsroom in. And my personal feeling is I wouldn't want to do that to a newsroom. I do think that there are enough great journalists out there who can understand the formula and the storytelling of any publisher and can do that work well. And particularly, as I said, having closer relationship between editorial and the custom content teams that, again, have very clear guidelines on what they can and cannot do, I think can solve that problem. But I do think that it also goes to a desire to be able to monetize a newsroom and not have to hire a whole new group of writers to do the work of the team that's already sitting there. So I see why some publishers do it.
And do you feel that it would be different if you were like a magazine publisher? Traditionally, magazine publishers have been, how should we say, the editorial side of the business has been a little working a little closer with sales, for example. So would you feel that would be different for a publication like the Wall Street Journal as opposed to magazines, for example?
I think we can say that it's different. But again, I go back to the belief that the audience is the most important person in the room. And therefore, I always want my audience to understand what they're reading and why they're reading it and who paid for it. If you can be clear with me on that, I can probably have conversations with you about that. But if I was building a studio from scratch, I would say my own personal belief is that it is better to have a strong, solid newsroom doing what journalists do, and having a strong, solid custom team doing what they know how to do, but having great conversations between those two so that custom content can go and do the kind of work that it needs to do for the brand, for the client, without jeopardizing the relationship that journalists have with their audience and the need for honesty and accuracy and fairness. And I won't say bias and sort of, because fairness and objectivity and all of that we get into, that's a journalism issue, which we all know about as well. So
You said before something about starting from scratch. Now, there are tons of publishers out there who are either contemplating starting a studio from scratch, or maybe they've already, you know, scratched the surface and they want to, you know, at least consider increasing the investment in the studios. What would you say to those people? How would you get the buy-in from C-level to start a studio or to expand?
So C-level within the publisher.
Yes.
I think, again, it comes back to charting your future revenue and being able, for the C-suite, for C-level, is being able to make the case that this business is a business that can grow and at some point scale. And that it isn't, you know, you're not just going to keep marrying cost and growth, but at some point, you're going to have a solid team that's going to have revenue that outpaces its cost. I would also want to make certain of the platform and the products. So by that, I mean, what does the publisher's operating system look like? What is the content management system? How adaptable is it to native content? Because not all publishers' content managing systems are created equal, and they're not all created for custom content. You know, oftentimes they're created with ad spaces that we, you know, try to shove custom content into. And so there's this whole other side, right, of distribution and how audience actually sees custom content that is also really interesting and fascinating. And what are those advertising products that we need to create and keep creating to be able to put this content in front of our audience in new and meaningful ways that aren't just, you know, mimicking a native article page or putting it somewhere in navigation where people can't find it. So those would be my first and foremost. What are my revenue goals? Do my ad products serve custom content? And finally, you know, what are the 25 top clients I'm going to go after because I see opportunity with them, even if they've done custom content with other publishers, or maybe they're clients who have never done custom content, but they love my brand. They love just traditionally advertising with my publisher. So those are kind of the three things that I would look at if I was going in to make a business case to a CEO.
And let's say you had made the business case and he said yes, and you were being charged with the task of creating a studio from scratch. How would you go about that?
So first and foremost, I do think it's important to keep costs to a reasonable rate because I do think it's really easy to grow, and then realize my revenue isn't pacing with that. So to start from scratch, I think one of the things is making sure that the sales organization understands how to sell custom content, or if you don't think that you can do that with the existing sales team, is to have kind of a crack group of people who really understand how to sell custom content, because it is a different animal to sell. And I've seen it with the salespeople that I've worked with who are really great at it, and other salespeople who struggle with it because it takes a longer time to sell than a traditional ad buy. And it also requires, I think, a salesperson who is as creative and strategic as the studio team, who can come up with ideas on the fly, who can brainstorm with clients really quickly and easily, and then bring all that brainstorming and be like, the clients are really interested in this. How does that marry with what the studio could do? So first and foremost, I would figure out, what does my sales organization need to look like to be able to sell this? Because first you got to sell something before you can make anything. And then on a team, I believe in, there are certain roles that have to be kept in-house, and then there are other roles that you can freelance out or contract out for the time being until revenue starts to come in. I think you need a very strong designer. I think a lot of clients are really looking for breakthrough creative stories that are told in different ways, whether that's through infographics or motion graphics, whatever, things that just kind of break the mold. Mm-hmm. So I think a really good head of design. I do believe in having a head of development on your team, because there's nothing worse than having a development team that sits somewhere else and you've got a program ready to launch and it's not ready. Mm. Something goes wrong with the code, whatever. So I do think having a strong head of development is important, because launch is critical. It has to work. It has to launch on the day that it needs to launch. The ads need to serve properly. All the logistical things that creatives don't necessarily think about all that much, but you've created something beautiful. It's sitting there ready to launch and something goes wrong, or it doesn't serve on a browser correctly. So all of those things. So a huge fan of having development in-house to a certain degree. And then editorial, a strong head of editorial, somebody who's really grounded in not only the craft of custom content, but also whether they come from the newsroom or have worked in the publisher's newsroom in the past and are coming back, but someone who's really grounded, as you've said, in the publisher's DNA. Hmm. How are stories written? How do they sound? How do they feel? So when we come up with ideas, those are very much grounded in the publisher's DNA. Then from there, a very strong project management lead, someone who is the quarterback on the team, who makes sure that everything happens on the custom content side and delivers that properly to the client. I can't say enough about having a very strong project management client services person who can build a team of great project managers. And then from there, it really is a matter of, is video going to be sort of a mainstay of your business because it's a mainstay of the publisher's business? So if that's the case, I would say you need a lead video creative. Is audio, you know, podcasting, is that where your publishers on the newsroom side, are they great at that? Well, then you should probably have a similar talent there as well. So I would say hardcore, it's a great sales organization or a team of salespeople who understand custom content, married to a small, nimble group of creatives who all work together. So, you know, edit, design, development, project management, they all sit together, they all brainstorm together, they all come up with ideas together. It isn't one group's job to come up with ideas and then make the thing. That's another area that I might be different from other people. Mm-hmm. I think if you come up with the idea, you very much need to be a part of the process of making it, because the idea is what gets sold to the client. And then if the people producing the product or producing the content don't produce it in the way that it was sold to the client, then you create a really bad situation. So I would say that's sort of my crack team to start. And then as things grow, you know, you bring in great freelance writers, you bring in, one last person I will say who may not need to be on that main team, but should be somebody pretty quickly who's a contractor and then brought on, is somebody who's just a really great copy manager, copy editor, someone who pays incredible attention to detail, how things are spelled, you know, like, is that map right? We make mistakes in journalism all the time. We have a process for correcting that. In branded content, you don't want to make a mistake, because it's the client, and the client doesn't want you to make mistakes. And so I have a great reverence for copy editors. I think that the loss of them within journalism has been a big disservice to journalism. And so I believe that they have a critical role to play within custom content as well.
So to summarize, your core team seems to be a strong head of development, a head of design, a head of editorial, a strong project management lead, and then either a strong head of sales or at least a sales organization that understands this very well. And then adding on from there, that would depend on your publication. So if you're strong on video, you need someone on video. If you're strong on audio, you need someone there. And then, of course, someone who can be a really strong copy manager. Would that be a fair summary?
I think that's a fair summary. I think it's important to keep the team small in the beginning, but make sure operationally that you can grow rather quickly, because that will happen. Going back to that conversation that you have with the CEO, when she asks you what you're going to need, once she said yes to it, I would say, I need enough on ramp in the next 6 months to a year to be able to hire quickly if necessary. You know, I think that is one of the tough things is, I mean, this isn't true just of custom content. This is true of any business, right? Is being able to hire fast enough to meet revenue, but not hiring so much that you're out of balance. But I think operationally, you just have to be, you have to be ready to bring people in, and maybe that's contract to start, but then a very easy path to bringing those people in full time as the revenue grows. So a pretty nimble HR process and a nimble hiring process.
I'd like to go back a little bit on the project management part of it, because a lot of publishers are building studios trying to, you know, create a mirror of the newsroom. Mm-hmm. And some of the positions that you mentioned here, you know, fit in the newsroom. But at the same time, even though you might not be, like you said before, acting completely as an external agency, you do need to act in some ways as an agency, right? You need to have some sort of the service level of an agency. And that's very different from a newsroom.
Yeah.
You know, they're not born and raised to service clients as such.
No.
Could you tell us a little bit of how you see the acting as an agency part?
So I think that is where project management and client services, and those can be the same people as your team builds. It can be a group of people. I think what's critical in acting like an agency is one, creativity, you know, boundless creativity that then you can kind of pull back in and put in the box of custom content that fits with the brand's needs and fits with the publisher's needs. And then in the end of the day is something that the audience just can't not read, you know, read or listen to or watch. But I think clients very much are used to dealing with a set of people from agencies that are critical when you're thinking about building a custom content team. And this was true at AOL and also at WSJ Custom Studios, is having a strong project manager on every single project. The person who manages the weekly calls, make sure that things are being delivered on time, both from the studio as well as from the client. Managing that day-to-day relationship with whomever is the point of contact within the client for the specific custom content program. That person does not replace, I will say, the salesperson. So I think the salesperson should always be a part of the process as the custom content program moves through from being sold into production. Because I think the salesperson is going to hear things potentially before even a project manager will. Things are going well, things are not going well. And so I think a strong connection between the salesperson and a project manager is important, so that they can serve the needs of the client, but they also serve as a barrier between the client and the custom content team, the people who are actually producing the work. Because I think one of the areas that I see where you can, sometimes it works really well and it's a happy relationship. But when clients start to feel that they can reach out to the writer, they can reach out to the editor and ask for changes or do something different, one, that starts to, you know, spread the relationship outside of the project manager. The project manager then has a hard time sort of following all of the stuff that's happening kind of on the sidelines. And so I'm not a big fan of side channel conversations with clients. The client conversations and the client relationship happens with the project manager, and he or she calls the right people into the room at the right moment to have the necessary conversations. So if it's something very much to do with editorial, then the editorial team is on the line with the client. If it's design, the designers are on. If there's a need for, you know, a full team meeting, we always had weekly meetings with every client just to keep everything on track. Sometimes they were 5 minutes long, sometimes they were 2 hours long. And I like weekly meetings. I like being able to stay ahead of any problems that might be coming up, but also hear back from clients what they're liking, because that's also helpful for a team, is hearing what the client likes.
Okay. And so a little kind of a broad question. What is good native advertising to you?
Good native advertising to me is something that marries really good journalism and the craft of that type of storytelling with a story that the brand wants to tell in an honest, open way that is delivered to me through the publisher in the way that I'm used to having that product delivered to me. That's sort of very broad, but for me, the best native advertising is native advertising that I don't know. I know it's a native ad, but I'm compelled by it. I am engaged in the story. I want to know more. Recently, I've never worked with Square, so this is completely just because I was looking for some suggestion. I was helping a client with like, what's great video, you know, in native. And Square, the payment system, has done these videos that are just really compelling, beautiful storytelling in which the brand is not front and center at all. It's just about people who are building businesses, who are doing really interesting work. And, oh, by the way, they use Square as their payment system, but it is very much a by the way. And what you begin to understand is that a product like Square makes being a small business person so much more possible than it ever used to be. because people don't need to have cash. You can be anywhere, do anything. You can be up and running really quickly in terms of your financial system. And I remember the story. One of the video stories is about a Syrian immigrant to the United States who decides to start making sandwiches that are reminiscent of what he had in Syria. So they're falafel, you know, pita, everything. Mm-hmm. He starts selling them, I believe, at his local mosque. They become so popular that he decides, you know, somebody says to him, you should start a business. And he's like, but I have, you know, I'm a Syrian immigrant. I don't really have, you know, the financial backing and the credit and all of that. And through Square, he's able to start his business and then is now growing this business into, I think, a national chain of these stores. And you're like, okay, how awesome is that, that a man from Syria can come to this country, recognize a dream that he just wants to give people like the food that he loves, and he's able to do that. That you could easily see any publisher on the newsroom side doing that same story because it's a beautiful story and it's a well-told story. That Square happens to be a character in the story is important, but it's not the be-all and end-all. And so for me, I think that is where great native happens, is when a brand understands it's about the story and my brand is playing a supporting cast role, a supporting character role, but I'm not the lead. The story's the lead. The person's the lead.
Mm. Is there any native advertising program story that you are particularly proud of from your work?
Yeah, I think the one that stands out for me, probably most people are going to think that because Cocaineonomics was our kind of claim to fame at the studio, that I would choose that. But in fact, my favorite program was a program we did for Mini USA, so the car brand, which was called Defying Hunger Together. And the remit from the client was to help them get out the word about their road rally. So they do one every 2 years where hundreds, if not thousands, of Mini drivers cross the country. And so in 2016, their drive was focused on a specific nonprofit. They also team up with a nonprofit for all of these road rallies. And the nonprofit that year was Feeding America. And so we came into the pitch saying that we wanted to investigate and explore the problem of food insecurity and hunger in America, but also explore the solutions, the innovative solutions to this huge issue. Some 45 million Americans worry about where next week's dinner is going to come from. They might not worry about where they're going to eat today, but they are worried about what happens next week. And that's a significant number of people. And what I loved about this is it had nothing to do with the car brand. It had, or the car itself, but it had everything to do with what Mini knew about its own community. And they know that their drivers are passionate about social issues, that they care about these things, and they cared about this issue. So their idea was, if we can get more people to care about this, we'll be able to raise more money for Feeding America. And so what we ended up doing is looking at food insecurity and hunger across America. We did three films about really innovative work and also went on the road rally with them. And this is where I got to be the person who comes up with crazy ideas again, which is I paired a writer and a videographer, and we did a story a day from the road for 18 days. So in the morning, my writer and videographer would show up. So in Atlanta, for instance, we followed a group of people who actually harvest fruit from fruit trees that exist on private and public property, because all this fruit just goes to waste. So they glean it and they take it to food banks in the Atlanta area. And then we all piled into a Mini and went on the rally to the next city. And my videographer, my video editor, sat in the back of the Mini editing the story, because we did them all via video, editing it down into a 45-second piece that then got sent to Mini for approval and then appeared on the site the next day.
Wow.
So it paired my love of investigating big social issues with doing, you know, real-time journalism. So I'd say Mini USA and Defy Hunger Together was my favorite part.
And it paired also with a Brave brand.
Very much so. Very much. And a client who really understood that he liked what he saw in the pitch. He trusted us. And he said, you go tell that story, and left it to us to do that.
Closing up here, I was wondering, would you have one very good piece of advice to give to publishers who wants to succeed with native advertising?
I think the piece of advice I would give is custom or native is not going to solve all of your revenue problems. It is a part of solving them and is part of a larger revenue system for the publisher, but hoping that it is going to be the thing that saves you, I think that's dangerous. And if you are in that situation, you might want to think about, well, what are the other pieces of revenue so that custom content doesn't get weighted down with that, because that can have the effect of potentially killing custom content for you, because you're putting too much, you're just putting too much weight onto that team and onto, you know, a product that clients might move away from. They might decide custom content doesn't deliver what we want it to, so we're gonna do something different.
I'm sure a lot of publishers are gonna be a little saddened to know that this is not the holy grail, but it was a good piece of advice. So Faris, thank you so much for taking the time to being on our podcast. And we're looking very much forward to seeing you in Berlin, where I know you're gonna be speaking at our event.
Yes. Yes, I'm very much looking forward to it.
Okay. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
So much great advice crammed together in such a short podcast. It's going to take a little while to digest, at least for me. Now, if you feel the same and you like what you've heard, please drop us a review on iTunes or SoundCloud. And while you're there, make sure to subscribe. You can also be notified each time we launch a new episode by signing up for our podcast newsletter at nativeadvertisinginstitute.com/podcast. And finally, if you want to learn more, please join us in Berlin for Native Advertising Days, November 6th through 8th. Visit nativeadvertisinginstitute.com/days for more information. That's all for now, folks. Next week, we'll have Melanie Diesel, one of the grand old women of native advertising, on the show. She's a branded content consultant, founder of Storyfuel, and the author of the award-winning native advertising piece, Women in Mates. So make sure to be back for more advice on how to build your own native advertising powerhouse.
That's it, you guys. Remember to subscribe to the Native Advertising Powerhouse podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud.